Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Well, Cassell was doing the radio. Was doing it.
Speaking of sports.
Speaking of sports. TV
speaking
show,
of sports.
When Chet Forty was at Columbia, was all American. And
a guard.
He was a guard, and Cosell said, "Come on my show," and Forty said, "Yeah, I'm not sure I want to go on the show. You know, I just want to play. I'm just a player." And he said, "Come on, it'll be fun, kid. You'll have a great time." So he puts it on. The first question is, Chet, is it true your teammates hate to play with you because you don't pass the ball?
This is General George Washington, and you're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
All righty then, plausibly live from an as-yet-undisclosed third-floor location in Chevy Chase, Maryland, that not even the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court knows about. We're on the air with Barry Zwerluga and Howard Fineman, the intergalactic editor of the Huffington Post, and Michael Kornheiser, and Nigel will run the board and we'll do news, and later in the show we will have Brian Windhorst. I just thought we would begin, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but college basketball last night, the number one, number two, and number four teams in the country were all beaten. They were all beaten on the road. Kentucky, the number four team, lost at Tennessee. Kansas, the number two team, lost at West Virginia. Villanova, the number one team, lost at Marquette. The most interesting thing, this happens in college basketball. You know, nobody goes through undefeated, and you're going to say, well, Gonzaga is undefeated. Yeah, but they're not going to win the tournament, so they're not going to go through undefeated either, because they're going to get to the tournament through the West Coast Conference without having played a meaningful game in 2 months. So they Gonzaga's never even been to the Final Four. This is what happens to them. They're in the wrong conference. But the most interesting thing to me, and I learned this yesterday, was the West Virginia. The West Virginia coach is Bob Huggins, who I think is behind Mike Krzyzewski and Jim Boeheim for the most wins of any active coach. I think that's true, or it's close.
It's close.
He's
it's
way
close.
Up there.
He's way up
himself
there.
Is up there too, I think.
Yeah, I don't know
no,
who's
but
ahead.
Huggins is
I think
it Huggins surprised is ahead a lot of people to know that he's that.
Huggins
that
high is a up. Graduate of West Virginia. Huggins was, I'm told, Phi Beta Kappa at West Virginia. I don't know Bob Huggins at all, but he has a clause in his contract that specifically pays him an additional $25,000 when he beats Kansas. Kansas is the number one team, obviously, in the Big 12. West Virginia got into the Big 12 fairly recently, 3, 4, 5 years ago at the most, because they have no West Virginia has obviously no business being in the Big 12. But he gets 25 grand. He's beaten him four in a row.
Yeah.
He's beaten him four in a row.
100 grand.
He's incentivized by this thing in his contract. Howard, I know, what do you make? He's an employee of the university. He's a state employee. I think technically he's a state employee.
Yeah.
What do you make about that $25,000 incentive? And he's hit it four. He's hit it four in a row.
It makes perfect sense. I mean, I actually know have watched him for years and years as a Louisville fan because they used
Cincinnati,
to be
Cincinnati right across the
when
river.
He was with Cincinnati, and they in Louisville used to be in the old Metro Conference and various conferences with Cincinnati, and it was always a nightmare to play a Bobby Huggins team.
They press like crazy.
They press beyond press. It's like...
They press
the press. I mean, it's really remarkable, and he's an inspiring coach, and the kids really love playing for him. He's just one of the best ever. And in West Virginia, Morgantown, West Virginia, you're Kansas, you know, you're big, fancy Kansas. You go rolling into Morgantown, West Virginia, you're going to be lucky to get out of there with your life.
So you're not offended by the coarseness of what – I mean, I'm sure he's making well over $1 million
on his deal. Tony, do you know West Virginia?
I guarantee you he's the highest paid state employee in West Virginia.
Yeah.
I guarantee,
of course.
By a million miles.
As is John Calipari in Kentucky.
Of course.
And, you know, and Patino at Louisville, which is a public university now. Yeah. Get your priorities straight, Tony. What are you talking about?
If you ran a university, would you try to say to a coach – you're sort of going to be like a waiter. We're going to give you a very low amount of money, but we're going to tip you very well for every single win that you get. We're going to put some numbers out there. Would you take that? Would you do it?
Well, I don't think he makes a very low amount of money to start with.
I know, so, but I'm saying if I were just negotiating a deal with a coach.
Not a coach of stature.
Because they won't do it.
But I would say that the way this is structured, if you are West Virginia and you are regularly beating Kansas, it means your program is at a certain level. Kansas has won how many Big 12 regular season titles in a row? Like a million.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say, and this is the obvious thing, but it everything in college sports increasingly comes back to this. Of course, college sports is about the coaches and not the players. And of course, the players who executed the plays that beat Kansas last night go back to the locker room and get $0 for beating Kansas.
And
the coach gets 25 grand and can't say, hey, guys, let me pass it on to you.
No,
you did great work in practice this week. It's disgusting.
I mean, if I'm Bill Self, I'm making a side deal with Bobby Huggins, and I'm saying, just give me 12-5 before I get on the bus, and I'll give you the game. I'm going to the NCAAs. What do I care?
You think 12-5 means anything to Bill Self?
No, probably not.
I mean, whatever, $3 million bucks goes a long way in Lawrence.
It's just, there is
Tony,
the optics of this in West Virginia, you brought this up. West Virginia is an impoverished state. I mean, the budgets in West Virginia are so small compared
Tony,
to many other states.
Let me put on my hillbilly elegy hat here as
right. Somebody
who worked in Kentucky for 5 years, grew up in Pittsburgh, knows West Virginia, spent a lot of
time
there.
Sure, it's next door.
It's everything there. In other words, if John Calipari at Kentucky were to say, you know what, I'm thinking of going back to the pros, or I might go somewhere else, as inconceivable as that would be, the state treasury of the Commonwealth of Kentucky would open up a new vein for John Calipari. That's the way it is in those places. And basketball in those regions, one of the only things that keeps Kentucky together as a state is the University of Kentucky basketball. And West Virginia sports in West Virginia, in a state that
big deal
is a huge,
big
huge deal.
It's a big deal. All right, as long as we have you here, and the great irony today is for years we would bring Barry in on the phone, and whatever we were talking about, I would just say to Barry, okay, where are we now? And depending on what sport Barry was covering and what Barry was doing, he would know exactly how to begin that answer.
This is an all here, where are we now panel here.
So, that's right.
So I'm going to you.
I'm going to ask Barry, though.
Every single day, it is a delight. It's, you know, the news fairy just rains down from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue every single day, obviously. Where are we now?
This is a reign of biblical proportions at this point. Well, where we are is that Donald Trump is assigning executive orders right now to demonstrate a sense of momentum and carry out, at least via executive order, various of the promises that he's made during the campaign, whether it's on the pipelines or on immigration or on federal hiring or pretty soon on the Supreme Court nominee, which would be a more substantive action in a way. That's what he's doing, and he's creating motion and news of storm-making proportions, while at the same time attempting to gain control of the reporting and the narrative and the facts surrounding his administration. This is a huge battle to see who controls public discussion and public information about his administration.
So let me get to that, because we had the introduction of a wonderful phrase, alternative facts, the other day. And now, because I watch the news in the morning, I'm old, and old people do that, and I watch it in the evening as well. We get to the point where it feels like it's going to be doing this for a while. I don't think it'll do it forever, but it feels like it's going to be doing this for a while, whereas Trump or one of Trump's people says something, and then the people who report it say, here's why this isn't true. And this, you know, first it was on how many people were at the inauguration compared to other inaugurations. And now it seems to be about how many illegal people voted. And it's like, are we going to be in the weeds on this all the time? Because at that point, someone is going to step back and say, you know, we're not seeing the forest for the trees. We're aiming wrong here. This is craziness. Are we going to be in this?
I think that's a very good point. And I think one of the things that's going on is that Trump is making a commotion out in the front of the store so the people in the back of the store can do whatever the heck
yes,
they want.
Yes, that's what it seems like.
That's what's going on here. And what really matters is what the actual effect of the executive orders and any legislation that he gets passed, but especially the things he does within his own administration, which he has more control over, what the actual rubber meets the road effect of those things are. That's the real story, not this unbelievable sense of commotion, which is what Donald Trump does. He is the world's best maker of commotion
right. In
chaos. That's how he thrives. That's how he's always operated.
But you don't have to take that bait.
No.
You don't have to. People in the media don't have to spend every single day saying, here's exactly where this is not true.
Well, what are you supposed to do when people at the presser yesterday with Sean Spicer said, you know, this thing about the 4 million illegal votes is ridiculous.
Of course it is.
And he says, ultimately, he says, well, that's what the president believes.
Right.
So that's beyond the argument about alternative facts. That's like, I don't care what you think. That's what he believes. So let's move on. So maybe we should move on. And like I noticed in the Post, you know, they have the fact-checking thing and the number of Pinocchios.
You can only get four and he's averaging six.
Yeah, right. They don't have enough Pinocchios.
No, they don't.
They don't have enough Pinocchios.
Hey, Geppetto, get in here. We need more Pinocchios.
We need more Pinocchios. So yes, but it's a battle of wills here. And what Trump is going to do as he slices and dices the media, he's going to make Fox, you know, he said yesterday Fox had not only the most popular and the best coverage of his inauguration, which is why they had the top ratings. So he's going to divide the press corps. He's going to have a lot of fun with press mechanics, and we're going to fall for it every second. But, I think you're absolutely right.
See, but what it becomes then, what it actually becomes is Celebrity Apprentice.
Yes.
That he sits at a table and he points at you and points at you and points at the other guy. And as this is going on, as you say, the people in the back room who are actually running the country avoid all scrutiny whatsoever. I mean, I don't have any idea what the Trans-Pacific pipeline, I have no idea what it is or the agreement is. But I'm wondering this, is Donald Trump going to systematically eliminate every single thing that Barack Obama did?
Well, first of all, the whole Trans-Pacific partnership thing was a bunch of hot air. It was not in force. It never even made it to the Congress for consideration. So he withdrew something that was never inserted.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is Trump's supporters, and to the extent that Trump has substance in his appeal, and there is some substance in it, said, we're sick of these international agreements. We think they're hampering America's freedom and ability to do what it wants in the world. They're a net loss for us. And that would include maybe even NATO. A military alliance with Europe.
I was just thinking of printing up NATO hats and selling them, so that might be a mistake.
NATO, the free trade agreement NAFTA with Mexico and Canada, and he wants to renegotiate all these. He's the art of the deal guy, and what he sold his voters was that I'm the deal guy. Look at all the buildings I built.
Yeah,
I'm gonna dismantle all these international agreements that limit America's power, and I'm going to renegotiate them one-on-one, the fancy word being bilateral. I'm going to get bilateral agreements where we win, where America wins, because I'm Donald Trump and I'm such a great negotiator. So that's the big picture globally what he's doing. What he's really doing there is saying, you know, the whole architecture that we set up after World War II of international agreements that's been in place since 1945, the United Nations, NATO, various other, forget all that. We're now in a post-war era, and I, Donald Trump, am going to define it by big, tough guy negotiations with other great leaders like Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, you name it. I will negotiate with them.
So the person who is in charge of explaining and defending and rationalizing everything that Donald Trump is going to do with the president at the moment is Sean Spicer.
Yes.
He's the point. He's the tip of the spear for all of these things.
Right.
What's the over-under on how long he lasts?
He'll last a while. He'll last a while. I think Trump likes him. Trump likes that he has a big square jaw. I'm not joking here. Trump likes the way Sean Spicer looks on TV.
Very attractive.
Big head, square jaw.
Looks like a bulldog out there.
Well, that's what Trump wants. That's Trump's message.
Right.
He doesn't want to be friendly with those people in the room. He's run against the press the whole time. And by the way, the press's popularity in America is zero.
Yeah.
Okay. No, we were universally despised. And despite
that's the way it's supposed to be.
That's true. That's true.
It's okay.
And despite all that's very true, Tony. You made that point the other day, and that's very true. We shouldn't whine about that.
No.
That's the way it should be. But Trump is using it to his own political advantage. And that's going to continue. The key people, as I said, are going to be the ones behind the scene in the White House and at the agencies who are going to be doing the real work. One of them, for example, the guy that they want to be the EPA administrator, He spent his he's out of Oklahoma. He spent his whole career suing the federal government to prevent environmental regulation in Oklahoma.
Now he's running it.
Now he's going to run the Environmental Protection Agency.
Fantastic.
I mean, that really is like the bank robber now being the chief executive of the bank. Unless you think that we are not robustly enough getting all the carbon out of the ground. I mean, this is a carbon-based administration. Forget global warming. Forget all that stuff. This is a meat-eating, carbon-consuming, Midtown Manhattan. You know, it's your kind of place.
What a great time to buy a restaurant in a
exactly.
city.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
What a great time.
You cannot
Look
serve
around.
Enough meat. You
meat.
Cannot, you cannot serve
Burgers.
Enough meat in this place.
Red meat.
And by the way, Trump's numbers, despite all of the hand-wringing here in Washington, Trump's numbers in the country have gone up.
Of course.
About 10 points.
All right. This is great. We'll take a break. Brian Windhorst will join us when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is the Movement Watch read. We haven't done this in a while.
Is this the Movement Watch read?
I'm really glad to have him back. Movement Watches was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. The watchmaker's goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at revolutionary prices. With over 500,000 watches sold to customers in 160-plus countries around the world, Movement Watches has solidified itself as the world's fastest-growing watch company. Michael, you've gotten watches, right? We have watches.
The show has received watches, yes. Your daughter has a Movement watch.
My daughter has a Movement watch. Chris Saliza has a Movement watch. Everybody really likes these things. I don't as yet have a Movement. It's okay. I've got I've got my own watch. But these are very good.
Trump says that he's leading a movement.
So there it is. These are Movement watches. Did you have something to say?
No.
Okay. The company was started by two broke college kids who wanted to. This is interesting because the copy says the company was started by two broke college kids that. Well, it should say who. So I'm just going to reinsert the correct grammar here, the correct word. The company started by two broke college kids who wanted to wear a stylish watch but could not afford them. So they started their own watch company. That's fabulous. That's the American dream.
Absolutely.
It really is. Movement watches start at just $95 at a department store. You're looking $400 to $500. Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. Classic design, quality construction, styled minimalism. Over 500,000 watches already sold in 160 countries. So you can get 15% off today by listening to this podcast with free shipping and free returns by going to movementwatches.com/Tony. Now, Movement is spelled in this particular way, not really, but in this way. Movement is spelled MVMT. So it's MVMTwatches.com/Tony. The watch has a really clean design. People get compliments all the time. And now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to MovementWatches.com/Tony and join the movement.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is sent to us by Chris Trott of Erie, Pennsylvania, hometown of the great Andy Beyer. His band is called Grandpa Crank, and this song is called Stand Up Straight. This music is always good. We need to put this music in a jukebox. Michael, when people want to send in their music for us to own forever and ever and ever, and pauperize them as a result, how do they do that?
They can send it to jingles@tonykornheiser.com, where we are only allowed to use it in the context of this show, actually.
Oh. Well, how about if they want to buy a coffee mug?
They can find coffee mugs at shop.tonykornheiser.com.
That's wonderful. Brian Windhorst joins us now, the great Brian Windhorst, who was in town about a little over a week ago, doing a story on John Wall, who headline writers mistakenly insisted I said must go. I said you had to think about it. You didn't have to must go. And we went, of course, to Chad's, the soon-to-be-renamed Chad's. And Brian had, if I recall correctly, Brian had chicken parmesan. Am I right on this?
Those who know me, Tony, know that I order chicken parmesan everywhere I go.
Good.
And that may seem like it's limiting. However, what it really makes me is a chicken parmesan expert.
Yes.
And I enjoyed it a great deal, and I hope that you leave it on the menu so that when I return, I can have it again.
It's going to be called Brian Windhorst's Chicken Parmesan. And if it's not on the menu, then when you're going to return, just don't make that a secret. We will put it on the menu. I guarantee you that. All right?
So what I liked is I've never dined with someone who was the owner of a restaurant before. And the service that we got, this is how I can illustrate it. When my water glass got a little bit low, they didn't just bring the water jug and refill the glass. He brought me an entire new glass of water.
Yeah, that's what happens every once in a while.
That was the level of service that we got that night.
What is so interesting about that is when people don't do that, they're fired.
Immediately.
Because I own the restaurant. And that's how it works.
A lot of glasses.
Yeah. All right, let's go to basketball and let's start. And this is sort of serendipitous for me. Because I don't know how many people know this. I guess a lot of people know this, that you are a graduate of the same high school as LeBron James, and you have known LeBron James basically his entire life, and you have covered him better than anybody has covered him, and you understand whatever nuance there is in his life. So we will start with LeBron James and his sort of, I don't want to call it a rant, but his explosion the other day after the Cavaliers lost. That's a bad loss, even if Wilbon wants to say it doesn't matter. You can't lose to New Orleans when they don't have Anthony Davis and when you have a triple-double and another guy has 49. You can't do that. And he had this explosion. So what's with LeBron? What is the state of the LeBron right now?
Well, he's upset. You know, I think he's upset more than anything because they've lost 5 out of 7. And in that 5 out of 7, they've lost to both the Spurs and the Warriors.
Bad.
Okay, so that upsets them right there, number one. Number two, the Cavs, they've only got two players right now, Tony, two, who average more than 2 assists a game. And really, that's not even 100% accurate. They've only got two players who average like more than 1.8 assists a game. And that's Kyrie Irving and LeBron James. And you look at the Warriors, they have 7. You look at the Spurs, they have 7. So this is the main competition LeBron sees in the league. He's just played them. He's just lost to them. And he sees their just number of guys out there who are playmaking. And he looks at his own team and he goes, we're a little short in this regard. And then there's the fact that he's averaging. And this to me, I mean, beyond his rant, this to me is where the personal foul is. He's averaging 38 minutes a game. That is number one in the league in his 14th year, coming off 6 consecutive finals. I think that is bordering on lunacy. And the reason he's got to play so many minutes is the Cavs only have 3 big men on their roster, and they only have 1 point guard. So guess who plays backup point guard and back and like one of the big man positions for a few minutes a game? LeBron. And they're doing this because they've built this team full of shooting wings and stretch power forwards, because those are the types of players that he is really good playing with. But because of injury and some other things that they couldn't have foreseen, they're a little short in some other areas, and they're sitting there with an open roster spot, and LeBron's frustrated about it.
Okay, so let's get to a couple of very specific things. One is, why did they let Matthew Dellavedova go? He didn't sign for any money at all, really, and they probably could have kept him, and he would have solved one of these problems, and he was a vital member of a championship team. And two, in his position as both coach and GM of Cleveland, why isn't LeBron, they went and got Kyle Korver, which is fine, but why isn't LeBron fixing this himself? Because he can. Why isn't he?
Well, number one, Dellavedova did get paid, Tony. He got $10 million a year.
Oh, I thought he was only about 6. Okay.
And the Cavs already have a $130 million payroll, which is number one in the league. So last year, for example, they paid Dan Gilbert, the owner, paid $54 million in luxury tax, just in tax. And this year he's looking at about $30 million. Over the 2 years, he's going to be in excess of $300 million in salaries and wow. tax over. And there's nobody even close. It's not like, well, there's pennies ahead. No, they're far and away the leader in spending. And the two positions that they're short on are point guard and center. And the point guard was Matthew Dellavedova, who barely played in the finals. He got $40 million over 4 years from the Bucks. And Timo Mozgov, who got $64 million over four from the Lakers, that's $16 million a year. So they let two guys go who were going to be, you know, making $26 million this year, give or take, and who guys who didn't play for them in the finals, essentially, but certainly would have played in the regular season. So that's number one. Now, where you can say they've come up short is they haven't replaced those players. And, well, they tried to. The two guys that they had to replace them are both out for the year with injury. They signed Chris Anderson, the Birdman. He tore his ACL out for the year. And they had Mo Williams, who abruptly retired the day before the season ended, stunning the team. And maybe they should have sniffed that out and found another option, but nobody knew that Mo was leaving. Mm-hmm. And he actually gave an interview to us at ESPN like 3 or 4 days before, saying, I'm looking forward to coming back for my last year in the NBA, and 3 days later retired. Seriously, that's how it went.
I want to just reset this. I mean, LeBron has fired coaches before. LeBron has been critical of general managers, has been critical of owners. Is Tyronn Lue in any sort of trouble? Is the GM in any sort of trouble? How will they sort this out?
No, and that's the thing, Tony. While the perception is that he is the GM, he's actually not. He actually doesn't get to make these calls. And you want the proof? Here it is. Here's LeBron. The day after they make this Korver trade, which they were so proud of, Tony, because in that trade, they got Kyle Korver. They traded away two guys who basically weren't playing. One guy was retired, Mo Williams, you know, and the other guy was Mike Dunleavy, who they got over the summer and wasn't even playing.
Right.
They traded away two guys who were not playing and a draft pick. And they were able to get Kyle Korver, one of the greatest shooters in NBA history, back. And because it was a two-player-for-one-player trade, they opened up a roster spot that at some point they will be able to fill with a player. They were so excited about this. They were like, we pulled this out of you-know-where. And LeBron looked at the trade and said, get me a point guard. LeBron wasn't even happy with it. And here they have it. That trade was three weeks ago, I guess. And they still haven't signed a guy. Trust me, if LeBron was the GM, there'd have been a guy signed. You know, the last 2 years, guys who were represented by LeBron's agents, J.R. Smith and Tristan Thompson, had contract holdouts. They missed all of training camp. I guarantee you, if LeBron was the general manager, those guys would have been signed in July. They wouldn't have been signed in November and October.
Well,
if LeBron was the GM, Tony, David Blatt would have been fired about 3 weeks into his tenure. Instead, he made it a year and a half. So he certainly has enormous influence. But the fact that he's so frustrated, I think, shows he doesn't have total control.
Well, one of the things that should happen is his minutes should be cut, and I would assume that that's going to happen. I also assume he'll take his week-long in-season vacation at some point coming up. But I'll ask the long-range question that must make everybody nervous. And that is, LeBron can opt out of his contract every year. He can do whatever he wants to do. He's the most important guy in basketball. Can you imagine him, Brian, within the next year or so saying, I won a championship here. You ought to be very happy with this. And now I want that dream team that only I want of Carmelo Anthony and Chris Paul and Dwayne Wade with me. And I'm going to go somewhere else and build it.
So it's a very interesting question, and after signing 2 one-year contracts, what LeBron did this year, and I can give you chapter and verse, but I don't think you care, but he actually signed a 2-year contract with his option for the third year.
Oh, okay, so he can't.
So he will not be a free agent this year, and it's interesting that now all of a sudden he's having issues with the team spending, because maybe the team doesn't feel like, now that there's a banner in the rafters, they have him under contract for 2 years, maybe the team doesn't. You know, last year, if I said in front of Dan Gilbert he wasn't going to the wall and spending here, he'd get pretty upset at me because, again, he's got the highest payroll year over year, 2 years in a row. And he'd say, I am spending. But LeBron would say, you're not spending enough. Go spend more. And that's really what the crux is here. Now, if this continues and LeBron gets frustrated about what he believes is them not going to the ends of the earth to get players and to spend, and that there's any sort of pullback, could he reevaluate his position in 2 years? Of course he could, but I think it's I think one of the things you learn about the NBA is it's so unpredictable, and seasons are so long, Tony, that you run into little snits and little snags, and I think that's what this is ultimately. I think he's just frustrated. They're not playing real well right now. They could rip off an eight-game win streak, and he could forget about it. And I think that's more likely than not.
Let me get to one other issue here that I like. I think everybody would agree that Russell Westbrook not starting in the All-Star game is a mistake, however you look at the voting and however it is weighted. What I wanted to talk about was Steve Kerr. I really appreciated that Steve Kerr ripped the players. The players are always saying that fans should never vote, and here are players voting politically and voting for people who don't even play. They don't even play, and Kerr ripped them. What did you think of that, and is there a lasting effect of that?
Well, ultimately, the league got what they wanted here, because what the league was trying to prevent was a mockery. And the mockery would have been had Zaza Pachulia, essentially because of computer manipulation, been voted into the All-Star game as a starter ahead of a guy like Kawhi Leonard, who frankly is, if it wasn't for Russell Westbrook, might be a leading candidate for MVP or James Harden. In other years, what Kawhi Leonard is doing. So it actually worked. Using the players and the media to balance it out actually worked. I think this can be solved very easily, and it won't happen when the media votes for stuff. And I'm sorry if I'm going to sound like I'm defending the media here. When we vote for stuff, we put our name to it, and you can see our votes. Now you have to know where to go to see it. But it's on the NBA website. Who I voted for MVP last year, 1 through 5, is you can see it. And the same with this. We all made our votes public. If they want to make, and I guarantee you, if you can be embarrassed by transparency, I guarantee the votes will be different. So I would just say make the players who vote put their ballots online like everybody else. And then all of a sudden, I think you'd see a different style of it. But ultimately, I think the media is the most responsible in doing this. And as much as the players, rail about, Kyrie Irving said he didn't think the media should vote. He thought it should be 50% players, 50% fans. And I say that if you look at who the media voted for, I think we have the most responsible vote. And by the way, we voted Westbrook number one to start.
I know that.
So I think the system actually worked, and that yes, there was a dozen or two dozen ridiculous votes by the players, but ultimately, I do think that there's 10 great players in there. And if Steph Curry had not been voted as a starter, people would have been upset about that too.
Thank you, Brian. We'll talk to you soon. It's a pleasure for me, and we will keep your item on the menu. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Brian Windhorst, who I think is fabulous. We will take a break. We will come back with news. I am Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
The Tony Kornheiser Show.
What do you do when you want a snack, but all you can find is junk food? Rely on your self-control to resist the temptation? Please, you eat the junk food. Start snacking healthy with Nature Box. Nature Box makes snacks that actually taste great and are better for you. Created with high-quality ingredients that are free from artificial colors, flavors, or sweeteners, so you can feel great about snacking. Nature Box recently made their service even better. Now you can order as much as you want, as often as you want, with no minimum purchase required, and you can cancel anytime. It's simple. Go to naturebox.com and check out their snack catalog. There are over 100 snacks to choose from, and they're constantly adding delicious new snacks. Choose the snacks you want. They'll deliver them right to your door. With Nature Box, you never get bored. There are new snacks each month inspired by real customer feedback. And if you ever try a snack you don't like, Nature Box will replace it for free. That's good. For free. Right now, you'll save even more. Nature Box is offering our fans 50% off your first order when you go to naturebox.com/TonyK. That's naturebox.com/TonyK for 50% off your first order. naturebox.com/TonyK.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
We're being played back in by Jason Fuse. He's a wonderful musician. This song is called Belief. Jason's stuff has been gracing this show for years now. Very happy about that. Nigel has news for us.
I do indeed, Mr. Tony, and we may very well look back on January 24th as the day or the night that the wave crested with the Washington Capitals. They lose 3-0 last night. They may never win another game for the rest of the season.
I don't think that's true. I think they lose on a back-to-back on the road.
Yes.
I don't think it matters. To me, this is like Golden State losing the other night in Miami. It just doesn't matter. The Caps not only are the best team in hockey right now in terms of points, and I don't know if this is the kiss of death or not. Melrose goes on TV every day and picks him to win the Stanley Cup.
It's increasing.
Every day he's on TV picking him to win.
Last night, I mean, they lose 3-0 to Ottawa, but every other game it seems like they score not just one or two, but
six.
Five or six.
Yeah, six. So they've been doing that for a while.
It's almost like the old school Bruce Boudreau, like happy go lucky puck putting in the net days from about 5 years ago when everybody criticized them that they would not be able to play that way in the playoffs and they get bounced and that's what happened.
And they did.
Except they think that they play the right structure now, all these hockey experts.
Do you have belief in them this year?
How can you have? I mean, I think they are a great team. I think they're the best team in the league. What does that mean in April and May?
Doesn't mean anything.
I mean, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, as a homer from Pittsburgh, I think you still have to go through Pittsburgh to get
you
there.
You do. Well, they're the defending champions.
Thing before the Penguins and the Caps played earlier in the year was the Penguins tweeting out a picture of the Capitals division title banner hanging in the rafters. And the Penguins Cup banner hanging in the Raptors.
And one is better than the other. Yes. What else you got?
Before the Wizards-Celtics game yesterday,
we need to talk about this.
The Wizards had said they were going to dress in black to replicate a funeral atmosphere. This is based on some of the acrimony that occurred in the previous game with the Celtics. Turned out it really didn't matter. They just blew them out 123 to 108
so
and never trailed.
Let's deal with that to begin with. There was a game about a week or a week and a half ago that was highlighted by Jay Crowder putting his finger on John Wall's nose and John Wall slapping back at his face, and we don't know if he actually hit him. But I think everybody was fined in this. The Wizards won that game as well.
They didn't.
Isaiah Thomas scored 7,000 points,
right,
and they lost that game. So now the Wizards want to have a rivalry, which is fine, and they seem to be publicly led by Kelly Oubre Jr. And I just, before we get into him, I would just caution that this is the guy who, after his freshman year, Bill Self at Kansas said, please get out. Please enter the draft.
Later on.
I can't stand having
you
around.
How many points did he score in Morgantown? Probably not many.
Not enough to keep Huggins from getting $25,000 that day. So he's the leader of the band in this. And I misunderstood this completely. I thought when they were going to dress in black to create a funereal atmosphere for the Boston Celtics, I thought they were going to wear black uniforms.
That's what I thought.
In fact, all they did was individually walk into the gym last night at various times, allegedly wearing black clothing. So I don't even know what that means. But the entire act of it and the publicity beforehand of it was provocative and antagonistic and threatening. And if there was a living, breathing commissioner at the NBA, and we know there isn't, but if anyone was alive who ran that league, he would have called the referees and the general manager of the Wizards and the owner of the Wizards and said, hey, knock this stuff off, because I don't want to have an atmosphere that is so highly charged that I think there's going to be a fight in the first 5 minutes of the game.
Yeah, but if you're the Wizards who, I mean, this is a big game. They've got some momentum. And they play in a 20,000-seat arena. In this big game against a marquee opponent, they draw 16,000 people. Don't you try to create any sort of buzz or relevance that you can? They have rebuilt their season when it looked like it was going to be lost, and I still don't feel like people talk about them. This will mean that people talk about them to a certain degree.
They talk the talk, they walk the walk. They did it.
They
won the game. They won the game handily. They're now comfortably in fifth place, and nobody is close to them from behind, and they're within a game and a half of third place in the conference because they can pass Boston and Atlanta.
Easily.
They look very good. They got 58 out of Wall and Beal, who were 23 for 38. They're guards. That's great shooting, and Jay Crowder did not stick his fingers in anybody's noses, even his own, last night, to my knowledge.
No.
They look very good doing this, and maybe you're suggesting that this is a turning point for them relationships?
If we've always struggled with, is this is a basketball town. It's supposed to be a basketball town, right? And we've got 5,000 people going to Georgetown games and 16,000 people going to the best Wizards game. I don't know. What do they have to do? It's a very good team at this point. They've always given us reasons to
question.
I was surprised.
14 straight at home.
When I went the other week, and hadn't gone in years, practically, I was impressed. I thought they were, as I said here, I thought they were really quite good. That first team is really very good. And Wall and Beal, when they're on, are really exciting.
I believe I had this. I believe I said that I created the turning point in their season.
I think you did.
Hasn't that an annual tradition?
By being critical of John Wall. So can I talk about my heart stress test yesterday?
Sure. That was actually my next news story anyway.
I was very nervous yesterday. I had to take a stress test on a treadmill, and most of the people in this room are way too young to have to do this, Howard and I have done this in our lives. So I get a call about a week and a half ago from my doctor's office, my cardiologist who doesn't want me and hasn't wanted me for years. I'm not going to do it, shovel snow. That's why I have Graham and Ellis across the street, because I don't shovel snow.
Formerly the Kip Sheeman's kids.
Yes, but they were a waste of time because they dropped enough salt down right. to melt the street down to the bottom of the earth. So I get a call about 10 or 12 days ago from Dr. Richard Rubin's office, and somebody says to me, you know, you missed your follow-up exam. I said, what? Yes, you missed your follow-up exam. I said, well, when was it scheduled? And this person actually says 3 years ago.
I go, I remember now.
And you're calling me now?
Yeah.
You're calling me now? You're from a heart guy and you're calling me now? Wow, it's optimism on your part.
They didn't call the mortuary.
So I scheduled a test, and the test was yesterday. I was a little bit nervous in here. I mean, it is a stress test, but it is something that gives stress rather than alleviates when you know you have mm-hmm. to take this test and you're worried about what will happen. What they do is, for those of you under the age of 90 who don't have to take these tests, what they do is they put a bunch of electrodes. It's sort of like when they take an EKG. They put the electrodes all over your body, and you then get on a treadmill, and these electrodes, I guess they're camera. I don't know how it works. I'm not smart enough to know. But they're taking pictures of your heart at all times as you take this stress test. The stress test is about 10 minutes of walking, and it gets progressively more uphill, and you don't have to
And faster.
Yeah, it's not that hard to do.
The objective is not to kill you.
Right, not to kill you on the spot.
And by the way, if it's going to cause you to have a heart attack, what better place to have it than right there in
with
the doctor's
with a cardiologist.
Office. Right.
You think they're going to be able to save you.
Yeah.
So I took the test, and after the test, when I was done, and I thought, very funny on the treadmill. I was doing some of my best work on the treadmill.
Well, comedy doesn't help on the treadmill.
No, but I mean, it was keeping me active.
Skew the results a little bit?
I was hoping that if I had very bad results, they would at least say, we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt because you're funny.
Right.
Because you're a funny guy. And I was being asked questions about what I eat and this, that, and the other thing. Anyway, so when you're done, what happens is you have to, and this is the hardest part for me, you have to lay down perfectly still as the photographs are processed of your heart, and you're not allowed to talk for a full minute.
A minute?
And the doctor was laughing at me because he knew this was very painful for me, that I was not allowed to talk. And then they show you the pictures of your heart, which, by the way, looks like, in the series of pictures, it looks like a space capsule. It looks like what the Mercury 7 astronauts rode in. And you can't believe it's your heart. It could be anything. It doesn't, you know, I mean, as it turned out, he said I was fine. And then, of course, I was afraid of being hit by a bus on the way out of the doctor's office. But he said I was fine. But they show you things that claim to be your heart. And it was sort of okay. And I mentioned on the way out, are you going to wait 3 years on the next one? And he said, no, but you're fine. And what I do at my age, and Howard, you probably, maybe you don't. You take the baby aspirin every single night. Do you do that?
Yes.
Okay. And I have Lipitor or whatever the generic Lipitor is, and a blood pressure medicine.
Well, what bothered me?
Michael's grinning because he knows there's a lot of inheritance.
This is good coffee.
Yeah.
Do you still take your blood pressure twice a day?
No, I don't do that anymore. And nobody's told me to. I used to do that obsessively.
You used to track it in the seat where you watch games, and you left it on a notepad, so I would just check it when you went out of the room.
Yeah, but I was within ranges. I was okay.
Well, what concerned me the last time I had one of these is that the doctor said, "Gee, we're surprised that you did so well."
Well, you.
I mean, I said, what do you mean you're surprised? You
present as someone about to keel over.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. They said, were you an athlete as a young man? You know,
you tell them about the classics.
Yeah, I told them about playing the liberating and tonic effect of playing rock and roll music.
Yeah.
In the 60s.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, we're surprised. No, we're surprised. Like the over under on you is a little less than
I thought you'd be dead by now.
Yeah, they're always happy when you walk out.
Right.
They're happy. I mean, so I told the story yesterday, and Frankie Nation said, when did you start taking these things? And I said, I don't know, mid to late 50s. I think they want you to go in there. And so he breathes a sigh of relief because nobody at PTI is over 10 at this point. Everybody's young. But it's, I was happy. Because I passed, I lived, and I passed.
Did you get a trophy?
I got apple slices. No, I didn't. No, I didn't get a trophy or anything. But you know, this enables me to last another day. So I was happy about that.
I love coming here. It makes me feel. Like I walk out of here with a spring in my step.
Yeah, so yes. Well, you
completely rejuvenated.
What else do you have in news?
I wanted to say a quick word about the Australian Open. The semifinals are set.
What happens?
It's going to be.
Where do they play that? In Australia, right?
They're going to play that in Australia this
this year.
In the middle of the night.
Yes, this year, yes. Well, for you,
by the way,
you wake up when the matches are starting.
Every year, and it hasn't happened this year, which is why I notice it. It's usually 107 degrees on the court in Melbourne, and nobody has complained about the temperature.
They're playing on ice, I think, this year as well.
Melbourne. That would be Melbourne.
It's sort of...
Oh, is that how it's pronounced?
Melbourne. I've been there. I've seen that stadium. It's amazing.
We've got the potential for an old-school finals matchup. The semifinals, it's Federer versus Wawrinka on one side, old Switzerland.
The Stanimal.
Yes, the Stanimal.
But Wawrinka beats Federer all the time.
He does now, yes. And Nadal advances as well. He beat the number 3 seed Milos Raonic earlier today.
Nadal only seems to be ancient. He's actually only 30.
Yeah,
but his body is
yeah, he's played so hard for so long.
So
he's broken
playing
down.
Grigor Dimitrov, and we could also have the Williams sisters could meet in the finals. It's let's see, Coco Vandeweghe, who took out the number 1 seed, she'll play Venus, and a woman by the name of Mirjana Lucic-Baroni, she will take on Serena.
So there are 3 Americans.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't.
Yeah.
That's very rare.
Good. Yeah.
Do you know the story of the 4th woman? What is her name again?
Baroni.
No, her first name?
Mirjana Lucic-Baroni.
Okay. She's the same age as Serena. She was a Grand Slam semifinalist 15, 16 years ago. She sort of left tennis. It blew up. There was parental abuse. I mean, she was a mess. She talked about it after she won, about how this was like the happiest days of her life in tennis.
Oh, wow.
She's 34 years old or 35, the same age as Serena, and she hasn't been back in one of these things in an awfully long time. This has got to be the old. I know Coco Vandeweghe is young. There are 3 women here, 35 plus.
Yeah.
This cannot be.
I think Venus is the oldest semifinalist ever. At the Australian Open, 36.
Yeah. This is talk about needing to take a hard stress test. That's what they do when the tennis matches are over. That's really an old collection of people, which is great. That's lovely.
And I know you wanted to talk about this melancholy Amy Trails Earl Foreman, who passed away.
For people local, and even before my time, he basically predates my time in Washington, D.C., and I got here in 1979. At one point, he owned a piece of the Bullets with Abe Polan. At one point, he owned a piece of the Philadelphia Eagles and the Philadelphia Flyers with his brother-in-law. Ed Snyder from Philadelphia.
Ed Snyder.
At one point, he owned the ABA team in Washington, the Washington Caps. They moved to Virginia. They became the Virginia Squires, which led to one of the most controversial Sports Illustrated covers of all time over 40 years ago, where Rick Barry called himself the reluctant squire and said, I'm done. I'm not playing in Virginia. I don't want my kids to say, hi, y'all, dad. And this was a big controversial thing at the time. He was a very, very important player in sports in Washington, D.C., and I believe died at 92 years old.
92.
So that's a long, I mean, no, you know,
good run.
You have to be a native here, basically, and over the age of 65.
I'm just in the midst of a pleasing reverie about the ABA.
The ABA was great.
Loved the ABA.
Yeah, the Pittsburgh Condors
were
before. They were the ABL.
ABL, Connie Hawkins, as you
Artie
say.
Artie Heyman.
Rick Barry, you know, it was great.
Long time ago. The ABA introduced the three-point shot.
Yep, that's right.
Which now has
changed
dominates everything.
Dominates basketball.
Yes.
And the NBA didn't want to have that. Didn't have that. They introduced that. They had a three-color ball. They had
Julius Irving.
People.
They had some great hair. They had some great hair.
At the beginning, they had Artis Gilmore at the beginning with the Kentucky Colonels. There could be animals in his head. He had the largest hair that anybody had ever seen. Darnell Hillman had some hair to him, too. So,
by the way, one final note. It was a great day, potentially a great day, for Lin-Manuel Miranda. He got an Oscar nomination for the original song, best original song for writing the song, How Far I'll Go. It's from an animated movie that you probably will never see.
I will never
see. If he wins, that's right. EGOT.
He gets the EGOT?
And not just the EGOT, Mr.
Wait,
Tony.
So he gets I know he understands he gets the Tony Award.
Well, he's won three Tonys.
What is the Grammy for?
It doesn't say here what it is. He just won Grammy
probably for
In the,
Heights.
In the Heights.
In the Heights is before Hamilton.
Yes, that was 2009.
Before Hamilton, right.
Yes. And he won a Primetime Emmy in 2014 for the music of the Tony Awards. So he won an Emmy for that.
That doesn't seem like a big award.
Well, it still counts.
Like I don't know. I'm working on a no-got.
Yeah, like you get no-got.
But he'll also get the P-got because he's got a Pulitzer as well. And he would be in a very
so
elite.
No.
Richard Rodgers and Marvin Hamlisch both are in that. Now,
no longer signing.
No longer signing.
No longer signing.
They also say he'd be the first potential Mac P-got holder, which because he's got this MacArthur Foundation
Genius Award.
So it'd be the
Mac
first one with that. And it would have taken him just a total of 9 years to amass all of these things, which would be the shortest amount of time.
Well, he's got the Nobel still.
Yeah, he's still got the Nobel that he's working on. So this is...
Wait.
And he hasn't taken a stress test.
Does he have the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame? So I got that.
Not currently.
Okay,
not
so...
Currently.
That's going to be difficult.
Come talk to me you get that. Yes. Does he have an honorary doctorate, which I'm working on? Does he have that?
I don't know
I have
about
several
that.
Of those, you know.
What do you mean you have several?
I have several honorary doctorates.
Several?
Well, three.
From where?
Well, Colgate, of course. That was an inside game.
Okay.
At my alma mater.
Did you go? You went up there?
I went up there and made a speech. I did the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Funny hat?
University of Louisville Law School, now called the Brandeis School of Law. Got one from the U of L. And then I gave a commencement address at Washington and Jefferson College, W&J, alma mater of
Roger Goodell,
among other people.
Well done.
And that's another that was a Pittsburgh thing.
You have three doctorates?
Yes. I would like you as a man. And wait a minute, Tony. I'm teaching a class at the University of Pennsylvania this spring, so I want to be referred to on the show
as Dr. Feynman.
As Dr. Professor Feynman.
Dr. Professor.
Do you refer to yourself? And when you make a call, do you say, this is Dr. Feynman?
No, you don't, because sometimes people who have doctorates, either PhDs or these things, they register at hotels as Dr. Feynman. You don't want to do that.
Why?
Because at 3 o'clock in the morning there's an emergency,
Dr. Kornheiser,
they look down the list,
Dr. Kornheiser,
and they call you, and then you have to come save somebody's life.
I've told this story a lot about Arch Campbell. So Arch gets beamed on the head. So we're at the T at Columbia at number 15, and there's an errant wedge that hits Arch in the head and knocks him down. And, you know, we're playing in a tournament, so we don't really want him to leave because he's got a high handicap and can help us a lot. But he does, and there's two doctors immediately in the grill room at Columbia that he goes to, Gail Delaney and Amo, Bill Amoroso. And one is a dentist and one is a vet. So Arch then goes to a real hospital to get his head checked out. We will take a break. When we come back, we will have Old Guy Radio. I am Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
SeatGeek is a smart way to buy and sell tickets for live events. The NFL playoffs down to one game. It's a can't-miss deal. It's a Super Bowl. Maybe you should go to SeatGeek and see what you can get, though it is going to be pricey. You can use SeatGeek to find the best deals on tickets to NBA and NHL games and college basketball and concerts. With SeatGeek, you always get the best deal on every ticket because SeatGeek price compares for you by searching multiple ticket sites. Prices can vary depending on where you shop, but SeatGeek will always find you the lowest available price. And SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck, and that's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You will immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Every ticket you buy in SeatGeek, backed by their 100% guarantee. So you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. And best of all, listeners to this fine podcast get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, one, you download the SeatGeek app, SeatGeek. Two, you go to the settings tab and you click on add a promo code. Three, when it asks you to enter the promo code, you enter Tony, T-O-N-Y. And four, SeatGeek will send you $20 after you have made your first purchase. So download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code of Tony today.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Old Guy Radio for the day. This is Proud Mary by Creedence Clearwater Revival. This entered the charts in 1969, 47 years ago, or 1970?
Yeah, 1969, so 47 years ago.
That's 48 then.
Oh, it is 48, that's right.
48 years ago.
Did you know that?
It's hard to remember how cool you thought you were listening to this music.
Yeah. This is not as good as the Tina Turner version is. Better than this.
Tina and I.
Oh, a million times better.
Yeah, it's better than this.
But for white people, you know, at a certain point, this was as funky as we got.
So in terms of critical commentary, Creedence Clearwater Revival, to me, and I thought about this last night because I knew this was going to be the song. And I will tell you that I think Fortunate Son is a spectacular song.
It's great.
And there's a bunch of things that I think that Creedence Clearwater has done that are very, very good. But I'm not sure they're great. I tried to compare them to somebody in sports, and Barry will understand this because Barry has covered golf.
I haven't understood anything so far.
Yeah, well, Barry's covered golf for so long. To me, Creedence Clearwater Revival is sort of like Patrick Harrington.
Sure. Won a couple majors.
Yeah. They're really good. They get all the awards, but they're not great.
No.
They're not at the top of the charts for me. So I just thought that.
One of the all-time great brother feuds.
They hated each other.
Yes.
And John Fogerty and what's his brother's name? They hated the other each other.
Yeah,
and one is not alive.
Yeah, it's not John. The other brother died, and John was on his way, I guess, to the hospital to sort of make amends and then said, never mind.
No, and it was worse than the Everly Brothers.
Much worse.
Yes. It was like
what about
really,
Oasis?
And that's
worse
bad.
Than that. Yeah, worse
and
than
I
that.
Think the Kinks was bad. I think Ray Davies and his brother, Dave Davies, I don't think they got along.
Dave Davies actually coming to Ram's Head in Annapolis. Is that a show you'd be interested in seeing?
No. No, because it's in Annapolis. Right. If it was in my backyard,
I'd see it. Can I take Rock and Roll Brother Feuds for $500?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I don't really have that.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you had
anything
in
the classics?
No, we got along. We kicked out our original drummer. We were trying to be like the Beatles. So
you kicked out Pete Best?
No, we kicked Jimmy Rosen, my best friend. I screwed him. Because he couldn't keep. I love him to this day, Jimmy, if you're listening. He's my brother. But he was a drummer who couldn't keep time.
Well, that's it.
Did you get the manager to can him, or did you guys do it?
They hired Brian Epstein's cousin. And they said, get rid of the drummer.
We got a guy named Alan Cox who came with a great lead guitar player. It was a two-for-one trade also.
Oh, well,
we had to get the great lead guitar player, Jerry Weiner, who became a studio musician in New York, could actually play unlike the rest of us.
Right.
So
it's wonderful. Classic tales from the classics. That's why people tune in.
It's my favorite thing.
That's why people listen to this podcast.
Love it.
We're going to talk to Barry about... Barry wrote a column yesterday in the Post that I really, really liked, and I understand that this is local, but I really liked it because it talks about a particularly universal theme in coaching. As you have heard on this program, the Redskins had to replace an offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator, and they replaced them from within. They had Greg Minuski, who once played for the Redskins and was on the coaching staff.
Colgate alum.
Is that right, Minuski? Mm-hmm. He was on the staff this year, and he went up to defensive coordinator, and the defense is terrible, and that's the reason the Redskins weren't in the playoffs, mostly. And they took an offensive coordinator from their quarterback coach, Matt Cavanaugh, who played a long time in the league, who I believe is a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh.
That's correct.
Right. And he is now their offensive coordinator. Now, normally, I would say that if you work for a rather large organization, when people promote from within, that's a very good signal to people who work there.
Sure.
Because it says, hey, you stick around with us, we're gonna find you and we're gonna promote you and we're not going to insult you by going to a search firm and bringing in somebody else. But in this case, Barry, you pointed out something absolutely critical about why these people may have been available and what their jeopardy is.
Well, I mean, I think there's a wide angle view here and there's a narrow view. And the narrow view is that for this these two particular positions, any qualified candidate, any self-respecting, self-assured candidate from the outside who's qualified for these jobs could look at the other openings around the league and say, why would I go to Washington now? We have a head coach who is entering the fourth year of a 5-year deal. It's essentially he's either going to succeed this coming year and get extended, or he's going to not coach. He'll be fired after this year. So there's no job security here. You would have to put an enormous amount of faith in Jay Gruden as a head coach and the front office's ability to stabilize the entire thing by getting Kirk Cousins to sign a long-term deal, and we've talked about that to death.
Well, we're going to talk about that again.
Sure.
Because of where he was last week.
Yes, absolutely.
And the two people who just left.
Totally. Right, but the wide-angle view is, and my view, and I think this is the view of a lot of people in the NFL, is this is not a desirable place to work. There has been 25 years of instability. Jay Gruden is the eighth head coach of Dan Snyder's tenure.
This is, by the way, not unique to Washington. There are 10 franchises around the league where you can say this exact
thing. Sure, but this is one of them.
Right.
And this is not a place where a standout defensive coordinator, the good coordinators they've had here, Sean McVay, who by all accounts did very well here, they discovered him from within. It's not like they hired this like mastermind from elsewhere. I just don't think that when the coaches get together and talk about, you know, where I had a great experience and we felt like we were supported every step of the way and the structure there felt like a winning culture, Washington never comes up.
So you can look around the league and the best example of promoting from within that is desirable is New England.
Of course.
This is what happens. All of their coordinators are attractive to someone else. And then Bill Belichick says, okay, you, Matt Starcia, or you, Josh McDaniels, you are going to be the next one. And that's great. And nobody looks around and says, oh boy, that's troublesome. Here in Washington, when this happens, you look around and you say, this could be a one-year job. Why do I want it? Now, You think that they have to make a decision on Jay Gruden sooner rather than later, right?
I feel like it, but I also feel like if your ownership, so okay, what have we clamored for here forever? Stability. Now if you're on the stability train, which I've been on before, the things that represent stability in this case would be Jay Gruden, who's coming off 9-7 and 8-7-1, which in Washington, amazingly, that's supposed to be success.
Yeah.
Whereas in New England, they've won 10 games, 14 straight years. You look at also in-game things, you know, the situations at the end of halves where he's bungled timeouts.
Yes.
And like, you know, is that the guy that you want to be? I think ownership is in a little bit of a corner here because they've preached, okay, we're going to finally do this the right way. But maybe they finally are going to try to do it the right way and they have the wrong guy in the chair. That's a very difficult – I don't know what the call is there. But if you're going to make it a place where a Joe Barry or a Wade Phillips wants to come and really invest and knows they have the time to rebuild the defense or, you know, keep the offense going, you're going to have stability at the head coaching spot, and that's a very difficult spot.
So you think that Jay Gruden, that this is the up or down year, the fourth
absolutely
year.
There's no question.
Do you think it's true for Scott McLuhan as well, the general
that
manager?
Is murkier, and that's where I don't know that I think there's a very interesting dynamic to be explored that I don't have a handle on of who is truly in power out there. Is it Scott McLuhan, which I think that the public thinks, hey, we finally got a real GM. We don't have Vinny Serrato, blah, blah, blah.
Oh.
This guy's going to be making the choices. Or is it Bruce Allen? Who has the power in picking these coordinators, in building the 53-man roster? I think that's an open question.
So I would say that if you were looking for a sign, the most important sign publicly would be, what are they going to do with their quarterback? Their quarterback is the number one attraction. If you look around at the teams that made the playoffs, almost all had a good to great quarterback. When you look around at the four teams left, all had a great quarterback at that point. And the lesson in this is if you don't have a great quarterback, you're probably not going to win. Kirk Cousins may not be a great quarterback, but he's the best they've had in quite some time. And he's sustained this now for 2 years. I don't think anybody would argue with that, although he was terrible in two games that had the most public exposure, the Carolina game and the Giants game. You have said for a while that you think you have to swallow hard and sign him. And maybe you were right until Kyle Shanahan became the obvious choice for the San Francisco 49ers. And John McVay,
Sean McVay,
the grandson of John McVay, left to conduct the experiment with Jared Goff of the Los Angeles Rams. And it's very possible that'll fail in a year. And so if Kirk Cousins doesn't want to stay,
he doesn't have to.
He says, give me the franchise tag.
Yep.
And then he's out.
Done.
What does that do to all of these other parts?
It's got to be, it means complete reboot, doesn't it? I mean, then I think if you go back to the summer of 2016, when Kirk Cousins was coming off of only one good season, and there was kind of an incomplete grade on his report card, it was, I think, a little bit harder to say, oh, you absolutely have to extend him long-term and give him all this money.
I wouldn't have done
it. But in retrospect, it's going to be the thing that costs – it could be the thing that costs them stability at the quarterback position for going forward, because Kirk Cousins, the night after he threw that gruesome pick against the Giants with a chance to win the game and send the team to the playoffs, he stood there at that podium within an hour after that game and did not say – you know what? I want to be the quarterback here for a long time. This is my team. This is my town. This is where I got my chance. He drew a line in the sand and said, hey, it's in the team's control. If they want to tag me, fine. I don't have any cards to play. He then goes to Atlanta, says he's watching two of the best at their craft. Kyle Shanahan is orchestrating Matt Ryan and that whole offense. And it just seems like Kirk Cousins is saying, I'll stay here for $24 million, and I'll do the best job I can, but I'll see if in San Francisco or maybe Los Angeles going forward.
That's exactly how I think it is right now. I mean, I just think that is the obvious photograph in front of people, and I don't think people want to recognize it.
Yeah, I think he's going to say, you know what, I'm going to take my ability to throw heart-stabbing picks elsewhere.
Well, okay, that's the flip side, absolutely. But I mean,
he's going to do that his entire career. There'll be a sizable contingent of people who will say good riddance.
He's going to do that his entire career. It's too many times.
It's totally,
totally
possible.
It's
no, it's totally and completely possible. And now we have another year of progress. And he set another record of the franchise yardage and all that. But he also killed them when it counted.
Yeah. One other note. When you were at Duke, were any of those years the years that Mike Krzyzewski took off and handed the team?
No, that was before my time.
Okay.
I had the two national championships.
Okay. So
I mean, I was kind of partly responsible.
Do you have any sense of what is going on now?
No, I mean, what I would say from the outside is that Jeff Capel is
going to land on him,
bungling his opportunity to be the guy in waiting. I mean, I'm not saying he would have been. There's some thought among Duke people that Wojciechowski has always been kind of Krzyzewski's son that he never had, and you know, he beat Villanova last night. He's doing fairly well at Marquette. I think since Krzyzewski took this kind of, you know, time off, there's the obvious question.
Operation.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be 70 next month. Like, you have to wonder. I think the timeline got a lot shorter. There was always this kind of like, well, he's going to coach until he wants to. Well, there's physical questions now too. So it's a very uneasy thing. It looks like they have some selfish one and done players on that team. They lose to NC State at home for the first time in 22 years.
And it all lands on Jeff Capel.
It does.
And what people need to realize, Mike and I talked about this on PTI yesterday. Mike Krzyzewski is, you just cannot, when he walks away, even for an hour,
terrible job.
The change is so drastic. He is a giant figure in his sport. Giant, and Jeff Capel may be the best coach in the world, and a lot of guys may be. You cannot take his place immediately.
They came into Louisville.
They
lost at Louisville, and I think probably the Louisville team thought, great, you know, we got a chance.
Yeah. I mean, he's that.
I mean, I covered North.
He's so commanding.
I covered North Carolina in the years after Dean Smith handed it to Bill Guthridge, his longtime assistant. There was a downward trend, and then I had – no one remembers the Matt Doherty years.
I remember because he's from Long Island.
Exactly. Yeah, and he coached 3 years there. They ran him out of town and then brought Roy back. But it is – regime change is hard because the coach is so central.
We're going to take a break. We will come back with Old Guy Radio. No, I'm sorry. We'll come back with
the mailbag.
Jingles and the mailbag
yes.
and a particular announcement that people are going to want to hear. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here comes comes Tony's mailbag. Got your email, faxes, and your notes. Here comes Tony's mailbag. Gonna read some for all you folks.
That's Gary Braun, of course. So Darius Rucker is on the Today Show. As we're taping this, we're watching the Today Show.
Oh, Darius!
This drops at 11 Eastern and 8 o'clock Pacific. So we're taping it during the Today Show time. And Darius Rucker probably didn't realize that in the East today, it would be beautiful weather, or else he would have said, I'm going to schedule an early tee time because Darius Rucker is a degenerate golfer,
yeah.
Which makes me very, very happy. And he could be in Washington where it's going to reach 60 degrees
yes.
this afternoon, which would make it an ideal day to golf.
Isn't he like a sports agent now?
No, he's still a singer.
He's a singer.
He's,
well,
a singer.
He's now an agent as well.
Yes.
Is he really?
Thank you.
Who are some of his clients?
I would assume he's still growing a list. I don't think he has any yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'd sign up with him.
Sure.
Before we get into the mailbag, I want to say thanks to ESPN's Brian Windhorst for coming on with us. I also want to thank our sponsors today, Movement Watches, Nature Box, and SeatGeek. Please support them the way they support our podcast. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of The Tony Kornheiser Show wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. And if you listen to this show through iTunes, please leave us a review.
Yes, and I want
to
make...
it doesn't have to be the review that Ross in Lexington left us.
Thank you, Ross.
It doesn't have to be that. And you have an announcement to make.
I do indeed. Jingle Fest is going to happen. It is scheduled for Saturday, June 24th. So you want to mark that on your calendars. All the regular jinglers will be there, the ones you love. Joe Arrow, Robert Berg, Kirsten, Jason Fuse, all those wonderful people will be there.
Jerry Negrelli is putting it
together.
As he has done for the last 2 years.
Yes, the location is still to be determined. So if you want to follow Jerry at Jerry Negrelli on Twitter, once we find out where it's going to be.
He's looking for some help in planning it and,
yes.
And welcomes all.
The chairman of the FCC, Ajit Pai, who
yes,
said.
Yes, congrats.
Maybe he'll be at his house.
Well, definitely. We'll definitely be there wherever it is. He's a total Jingle Fest fanboy.
So there you go. And we will keep you appraised as time goes on as to what is going to happen.
Yes.
From old Milwaukee John Pelton, the Sports Writers was a Sunday afternoon radio program on WGN. This is the original thing that led to all of the covers, including the more famous national show on ESPN, The Sports Reporters. It began in 1975. George Langford was the host. He was a sports writer and editor at the Chicago Tribune. He was joined by Bill Jouse, also at the Tribune, Bill Gleason of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Ben Bentley, a fight promoter. It was a different time and place, but the arguments were the same as today, only with cigars and papers, and he said he loved listening. It became a television show. Rick Tellender, who was one of the most accomplished athletic sports writers of all time. He started as a defensive back at Northwestern University. Rick Tellender, when he was working for the Chicago Sun-Times, was the youngest person on that show. And that show led to, as I explained yesterday, led to the ESPN Sports Reporters.
I have a kinship with him. In this room, I feel like the youngest person.
You are the youngest.
Yeah, I feel like the Rick Tellender of this show right now.
I'm only 17.
So there you
Sorry.
Go. Bill Springer in Asheville, North Carolina. I remember watching the Sports Reporters back when you were a semi-regular. But the show got much better after they replaced you with John Gruden.
Well, that's just hard to dispute, isn't it?
I mean, the list of people who got television starts there, basically, is just, it's 50 deep. It's really a long list. From Bob Harbaum, who writes in Gaithersburg, Maryland, Mr. Tony, the rest of the story on the Neil Diamond-Barbara Streisand connection that I talked about yesterday as being the greatest thing I've ever seen on the Grammy Awards. They attended Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn together, sang in the same school choir, and yet claim they never met until both recorded versions of You Don't Bring Me Flowers. The two recordings were edited together by a DJ in Louisville, Kentucky, which led them to re-recording it as a duet. Streisand, incidentally, says her high school crush was a quirky intellectual oddball who I like to call Bobby Fischer. Bobby Fischer did go to Erasmus Hall High School as well.
Pretty good alum they've got.
As did Billy Cunningham, who was probably the greatest basketball player to ever come out of Erasmus Hall. Brian Davis, Washington, D.C. I'm a new millennial living on 16th Street in D.C. This weekend, my girlfriend and I decided to escape the chaos of the inauguration for the debauchery of New Orleans, where I attended Tulane University. One night, we ventured into the world-famous piano bar at Pat O'Brien's, where patrons can enjoy sugar and rum-filled hurricanes while listening to their requests being played by one of two pianos in the bar. I immediately grabbed a napkin and a pen, and I scribbled down my song suggestion, handed it to the pianist, who then read my note to the bar. Do you know I have a piano? Only a little will. If not, I guess Sweet Caroline will do. Within seconds, bellows of La Cheeserie occurred at opposite ends of the loud bar from complete strangers, indicating the pianist might have felt left out. To wrap up our trip, we were supposed to arrive back into Reagan Monday morning, but the 50-mile-an-hour winds and pouring rain prevented our landing just before we touched down. We ended up diverting to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania after another hour. Being an anxious flyer myself, we ended up getting off the plane, renting a car to drive back to D.C., and doing some serious late-night research into talismans and amulets. It's the right way to go. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
So today I'm announcing my resignation from Congress.
No.
Yeah! Bye-bye, pervert!
Bye-bye, pervert.